When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome back to the House of Man, the latest addition to the House Lights Mansion. I'm one of your hosts, John Mills. And before I introduce the other two hosts of this show, there are going to be a lot of things said about big tobacco and the landmark cases of the 1990s. And I, for one, would just like to get ahead of it and say that a sincere thank you to big tobacco for all of the years of great flavor and relaxation that they delivered to me during that exact time period. Where I probably grabbed a cigarette after watching The Insider by Michael Mann. And here to explore this based on a true story crime court case epic by Michael Mann is the Attorney General, Tristan Riddell, and private investigator, Darren Moser. Tristan, Darren, are you ready to get down to brass tacks and get to the truth of all
this? I'm just walking into the ocean on my cell phone, because that's what you do when you're talking to people.
It boosts the signal. Water actually causes the signal to bounce better. That's what
you do. And it gives the director's signature.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
You being like super blue on the beach at nighttime.
Yeah. You know, somebody should write, Michael Mann loves two things if you look at his filmography, trains and the ocean. And if somebody could just build a train on the ocean, Michael Mann would be the happiest person on the planet. But, of course, we're here on the Nerd Party. Drop us a line over on thenerdparty.com/contact. The usual sort of rigmarole out there with everything. And here we are with 1999's The Insider, a film that basically did a dramatization of very recent history and really added a lot of additional drama to an already intriguing story. Anybody not familiar with it, The Insider is based on the real-life story of a whistleblower who came forward at a key moment to 60 Minutes to talk about what was actually known or unknown, but specifically known in the halls of big tobacco companies and how they manipulated statistics and their different testimony in front of Congress and everything about what they knew and when. And it changed the course of basically American history, no lie. So here we are with something that is dramatizing a very landmark event, but it's recent enough history that as people are watching it, they remembered the headlines and those sorts of things, or at least most of them. And what I want to do is, you know, we always ask, you know, and Tristan, I'll throw it to you first, was The Insider in 1999, the summer that saw The Matrix and Star Wars Episode One and The Sixth Sense, was The Insider on Lil Tristan's checklist of movies he had to see at the cinema?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, considering I was 13 at the time, I think The Matrix Episode 1 and The Sixth Sense won out in regards to my attention to the cinema. No, I did not see this movie in the movie theater. And I actually, this was the first time that I've seen it since ever. Like, this is the first time I've seen it. I didn't see it on rental. I didn't see it in the theater. I didn't see it. I must have seen part of it on TV, because I remember the scene with Christopher Plummer and Al Pacino interviewing the sheikh and where Christopher Plummer is like purposely, you know, like starting a fight, and Pacino says like, okay, do you want to screw around a little bit more, or is your heart rate up enough? And he's like, no, I'm good. My heart's going. And I remember that scene vividly because I've been kind of in that situation when I've needed to get pumped up before I get on camera. And, but that's all that I remember. I don't remember anything else in the movie.
Okay. So this is essentially a first viewing for you, and this is a first viewing for you as well, Darren?
Yes, this was the first time watching this. And yeah, I almost felt like, did I start the wrong movie? Because this is not what I was expecting in the very beginning.
Right? Like when the opening, like I had that thought too, where I was like, did I click on the wrong one? Like this doesn't look like a Big Tobacco insider thing to me.
Right? And it is a jarring opening. It's a very interesting opening. And I think it does a great, great job of establishing Al Pacino as the real life figure, Lowell Bergman, a news producer who's always in search of the story and getting different subjects up on camera. But a follow-up question I think that's necessary for this is, while you were both younger and you didn't necessarily go see The Insider in the theater, were you aware of everything that had transpired in terms of Big Tobacco and all of the revelations that came out in the 1990s, exposing that they knew well and truly that they were in the drug business?
I do remember a bit from, yeah, just kind of current history and such like that, like covering that in high school. You know, the way that the 90s would kind of cover that kind of stuff, where it's like a footnote in a specific textbook that's fairly recent. So, yeah, I did know a little bit about like this landmark case and, you know, the whistleblower and again, just the CEOs getting caught, you know, not telling the truth, because that thing was starting to happen, you know, where that wasn't really a thing before that time. But that's really all I knew. I didn't know like the specific story. I mean, I know what 60 Minutes is and, you know, all of that. But yeah, it's very interesting watching this movie now with the ringer journalism as a whole has gone through in the past like decade. Like, because the way they're talking about it, like you would not talk about journalism nowadays in that way, at all.
Well, that's a very fair point. That is something that I think is interesting. And Tristan, let me get your thoughts on this. I would say that you could posit that this is a moment, as you trace the character arc of Lowell Bergman, where he saw where it was headed, where basically sponsors and commercial interests would come to dominate what was dictated on news screens, because that's the big conflict in the latter half of the movie, is we're going to let our shareholders and what money we can make determine what makes it to the screen. That's not what this is supposed to be about. And that's the fight that happens. And to Darren's point, I think that we all take a decidedly more cynical view of the motivations behind news organizations nowadays and what truly motivates what gets on screen. I'd say that's a fairly universal thing. So do you see this film taking on an unintentional shift in later years since, where it's not so much about Big Tobacco, but about what happens, what is about to happen to the industry of journalism as a whole?
I don't think it was necessarily on purpose to showcase I don't think it was a foreboding sense of things to come. I think it was definitely, it was great in three parts. It was establishing the connection where Al Pacino's character is trying to get the interview going. Like, he's establishing trust. He's establishing the relationship. Second act is making it happen, getting everybody together, making all the pieces fall into place, you know, getting the testimony public and everything like that. And then the third act is actually trying to get it on the air, where it's very much shifts to purely Al Pacino's story. Like, I feel like they kind of share the spotlight. for a majority of the movie. But once you get to Act Three, it is very much Al Pacino's story of trying to get it on the air. And Russell Crowe kind of takes a back seat. And so because it's the third act and we get to the quote unquote climax, and then, you know, we have the falling action, the denouement, and everything like that, I think a big focus is on the battle between corporate and journalism. And I mean, this was news. This made the news when, like, somebody even just floated the idea that CBS corporate was dictating 60 Minutes news stories. You know, like, that was a big deal back then. Now, if somebody said that to us, we'd be like, yeah. And
yeah.
What? Like, what else is new? You know, like, what do you expect? It's 2022. And so I don't know. I think it definitely does showcase the fall of journalism and the things to come. But I don't think it was that was the intent.
Oh, I agree with you. I agree. It wasn't intentional. I'm saying it has, because
looking through the lens of history
since. Yeah. It winds up taking on this added importance that it takes the focus away from just that big tobacco. Because at the time that this came out, a lot of the focus was, a lot of the takeaway that people had was about Russell Crowe's character, about Jeffrey Wigand, and about turning whistleblower on the big evil corporation. And that was one of the biggest takeaways. And I'm just saying that I think that with more time passing, I think that it takes on an added significance, that Lowell Bergman's story carries more resonance than it might have back in 1999.
Yeah.
So this happened in the early 90s, mid 90s, somewhere around in there. As aforementioned, in 99, I was 13. And so I was even younger then. This very much, you know, went over my head. Like, this stuff that was going on, like, I was aware of OJ, I was aware of the Unabomber, but tobacco, not on my radar whatsoever. Like, no one really in my family smoked. It was just something they had to deal with when you went to a restaurant, or, you know, like, you wanted to play pool, and everybody knew that it was bad for you. So, like, it didn't really impact me or my life or anything like that. But now looking back on it, and when I'm more educated about the history of big tobacco and the struggle of, especially like going into advertising, like and marketing, which I am now, I remember talking to a friend, a coworker of mine who worked for, I think it was Virginia Slims. His account was at Virginia Slims, and he talked about all the do's and the don'ts when it came to advertising, because like he was there in the 80s and the 90s. And like that big shift that happened. I mean, of course there was a big shift, you know, going from the 50s to the 60s, but there was also a shift going from the 80s to the 90s. And it's pretty insane what you could and couldn't do. And we're actually kind of seeing that now with vaping. And like, with, I think like there's a landmark case with Juul going on right now. So I was actually thinking about the movie because I saw something on AP where it was talking about a nicotine delivery device. And I was like, oh, I just heard that. Mm-hmm. Like, I heard that just the other day. This movie is, to get back to the root of the movie, like, this movie is impactful on multiple levels, even today. You know, like, even though it came out in 99 and it's about something that happened in the mid to early 90s, you know, it's talking about nicotine delivery systems harming the American public, you know, about CEOs lying to the American public, and journalistic integrity, all stuff that we are still battling with today, sometimes with a more, you know, with more cynicism than rose-colored glasses.
I think that one of the very interesting tactics that this film deploys is that it takes these characters and it makes them very at home in a Michael Mann world. Now, since this is your first time seeing it, Darren, did these characters strike you as real people?
or did they strike you as inventions meant to represent a certain type of person?
No, I felt that they represented real people. It was really engaging. I really enjoyed Russell Crowe's performance because, again, mostly when I think of Russell Crowe, I think of like Gladiator. And not that Gladiator is not a great film, but he's got some chops in this movie because you feel this is a man losing his world and everything is falling apart and the paranoia that's creeping into his performance. And like, there is a lot of tension, like good dramatic tension in this movie. And that's really impactful. But I definitely also agree with Tristan that the third act, and I think I couldn't put a name on it, but when you said it, Tristan, that the third act kind of shifts the protagonist to Al Pacino from, and that's what kind of lost me a little bit. Not that I don't enjoy that part of the story, but when I was watching this, the third act, I was like, I felt like we had the climax. Like the climax was it not getting released. And then I'm like, there's a third left of this movie, but it's almost a different movie. And I don't know. I think that's going to kind of weigh on my rating a bit because not in a very negative way, but just it was kind of unexpected because it takes this turn in the last act.
One thing that I do want to comment on, John, that you asked Darren about representation of real people. I never really felt like, oh, I'm watching a documentary or I get lost in their performances, even though they're fantastic performances. And the reason why is because when the Mississippi district attorney came in, I was like, that's a real guy. I was like, that's not an actor. That is a real person. For some reason, I can usually tell. And I'm not saying I'm special. I'm just saying that I can do that, like where I can usually tell when somebody is playing themselves or they're like, oh, this person actually is a lawyer, not an actor. And it's not just because you haven't seen them before, because there's tons of people in this movie that you haven't seen before. But there was a realism to his acting where he's not acting like he's acting.
Yes.
And I look it up and I'm just like, oh, holy crap. He actually was the Mississippi DA during this whole thing. It was kind of like in Goodfellas when at the end, when they're trying to get into Witsec, the guy who is talking to him and saying, and like, you know, like Leota saying, like, I just don't want to go anywhere cold. You know, I just don't want to go anywhere cold. And like his wife saying is like, oh, I don't have to do this, right? And he says, he's like, listen, I've heard the tapes. Okay, you're just as guilty. Like his performance was so real. I looked it up and he was the detective that brought them all down. Like he was the real person on the case. And there's just like certain moments like that. And that kind of contrast showed me that this wasn't a relaxed, how do I put it? Like, fall into the role documentary style acting. Like this was a dramatization. This was amped up to 11. Now this experience of course is crazy. I love that quote from Al Pacino's character when he said, he's like, these are regular people in extraordinary circumstances. Like what do you expect? Consistency and grace. And these people, you know, went through this, but you could tell that this was a dramatization, to answer your question that you gave to Darren.
So I want to touch on performance before jumping, to my next question specifically about Mann and his style. But as long as we're talking about performance, before we move on, I want to say that one of my favorite scenes in this film, and definitely from any film of 1999 or possibly of any film that I've seen, period, is the actor Bruce McGill, who, you know, he has...
Fantastic actor.
Playing
does not get enough credit.
Yes, but playing Ron Motley, and when they're taking Wigand's deposition, and he absolutely loses his mind. You know, wipe that smile off your... Like, I'm legitimately afraid of him in that moment. Like, that is so much raw
energy to project across. And I think he's just, it's not the largest role in the world, but he does so much with it. And I think that the person a lot of times in this film that gets unfairly overlooked is Diane Venora, who, working with Mann again, you know, she was in Heat as Al Pacino's wife, and she is Wigand's wife, Leanne, in this film. And I think she does a very good job with the role of making a believable. I think that there's an interesting contrast because she at times seems more like a real person than some of the headliners that are out there. And I think that Diane Venora unfairly gets overlooked a lot when we talk about the performances in this film. But speaking of the film as a whole and Mann's style, I would argue that we've definitely seen an evolution in Mann's style from Manhunter to Last of the Mohicans to Heat to this. And so, Tristan, I'll kick this one to you first. When you look at this film, do you see the director who was still establishing himself in 1986's Manhunter? Do you look at this film and you say, yeah, this is the same person that was directing that? This is a logical progression from that point, a decade and a half later. Or do you look at this and you say, wow, he's learned so much. It's almost as if that person doesn't exist. Like, he has so exceeded his past directing style that I don't even see that anymore. He's gone to another level.
It's a little hard for me to answer because I feel like even with Manhunter to this, there are little things that you see. There's little signatures along the way. It's kind of like looking at Wes Anderson's Rushmore and Wes Anderson's
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Thank you. Yes, I was completely blanking, even though that's not even his latest release. But that is the one that I was thinking of. Like when you see those two films, they're very, very, very different, but yet you can tell they're the same director. I'm kind of that way with Mann and these two films, but with me, knowing his filmography and what's coming after, I can see much more of the Collateral director in this than I can the Mohicans director.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like when you go from Mohicans to Heat to this, you see a much more natural progression to Collateral than if you went another direction, than if you went from, like, if you went from Manhunter to Collateral, you'd be like, what the hell is going on? You know, is this even the same person? But if you go from Insider to Collateral, you know, it makes sense. Now, you could say that about any director, you know, when you talk about that gap of time. So I'm not saying anything revolutionary, but,
you know, I
would
actually throw out there, even specifically with the films that we have discussed, you know, in this House of Man section of House Lights, I would say that, and this can come across as negative, but Darren, let me ask you, I would argue that of the ones we've looked at, Last of the Mohicans is the anomaly. I can see a direct line from Manhunter to Heat to The Insider and forward. Last of the Mohicans, the color palette is much more expansive. It's a much larger type of movie, type of storytelling, much more mythic, much more legendary sort of thing. Whereas Manhunter, Heat, Insider are very small personal stories, a lot more close-ups, like extreme close-ups and over-the-shoulder shots and those sorts of things. So, Darren, do you think I'm way off base here? Am I stretching for this? But I see Last of the Mohicans as almost, that's the outlier in these four films we've looked at.
No, I would agree. It's probably just a case of four factors lighting up at the right way, like the story, the fact that it's the majority outside, the particular cinematographer, you know, the type of, you know, impact that he's going for. And yes, I agree that it's an outlier, but I think that is kind of why, like, it's like, oh, well, it's not a news kind of story, or it's not based off of something, it's set a long time ago. And so you get enough of these dominoes in play, and it's just expanding that gulf between Mohicans and his other work. But yeah, no, I just want to see Daniel Day-Lewis ride into the court and just, you know, take some names.
Tristan, let me ask you this, just to piggyback off of that. Do you think that Mohicans lends itself to certain differences, not just what Darren, I think, rightly points out, that it's the type of story is different, that it is of these stories an outlier type of story. But do you think that the limitation of what he could get away with the equipment dictated a lot about Mohicans being in a natural setting and the way things had to be set up? Whereas with these types of movies, these quasi-documentary dramatization sort of feel, he can get a lot closer in because the equipment allows more for that, rather than when Hawkeye is at night in the cemetery, you know, in the secret graveyard. It's a lot harder to get that type of shot.
What's your question?
We know that man likes to push technical aspects. Yeah,
okay.
What I'm saying is acknowledging.
Are you asking if the insider director was the collateral director, the insider director?
If the technology were different, if he were able to get these types of shots in Last of the Mohicans, do you think he goes for them, or do you think the material still dictates the way that that's shot?
I'll answer that in a couple different ways. If he was making this in 1999, I think it would have been the same. I do. I think it would have been relatively the same. If this would have been when did Collateral come out, 2004?
Yes.
If this would have been 2004 Michael Mann, it would have looked like garbage. He would have ruined Mohicans. He would have absolutely ruined Mohicans. He would have shot it on tape. It would have looked horrible. It would have looked garbage. It would not have served the story. Thankfully, with Collateral and Miami Vice, you know, when he's experimenting with HD tape, you know, it lends itself to the story, in my opinion. It lends itself to the vibe and the flair and the overall feeling that it's going for. He utilizes it as a tool, as what great storytellers do. But then when he gets to Public Enemies, it's a complete misfire when it comes to visual storytelling. Complete and utter misfire, because he's so obsessed with digital, he's focused on making the digital happen more than making the story happen within the digital realm. And it's kind of like when Lynch discovered digital, it doesn't really matter what a Lynch film looks like, you know, in like 90s onward, because it's really all just about the aesthetic. And with Mann, I feel like there's two Michael Manns, and there's digital Michael Mann and then there's film Michael Mann. And I have a love-hate relationship with digital Michael Mann.
Okay. No, I think that's fair enough. Something that I'm going to make a point for us to get to earlier than usual, and we all love to talk about the music of the films. Darren, this score, this soundtrack, features Lisa Gerrard, who would later feature very prominently in a later Russell Crowe movie that's just around the corner called Gladiator, directed by Ridley Scott. Do you feel, now having seen The Insider, which came out before Gladiator, that there is a sonic fingerprint that might have snuck its way into Gladiator from this film? And then bigger, more important follow-up question is, what did you think of the music in this? Because Mann has always been known for picking really great music for his films. Do you think that he lands it well with Insider? Do you think that the music in this brings out anything, or do you think that it remains sort of as a background effect?
No, I think the score in this was great. I touched on it earlier, just looking at Russell Crowe and his acting and the chops that he displayed, the tension in this movie and the train ride you were on for at least the first two thirds is like, it is, I'm almost slipping into like, you know, because you have like stalkers going on. Like, it's almost a, you know, what you did last summer kind of vibe, where something's going to jump out and get you. And because I'm like, I don't know the story enough. Like, is someone going to shoot his family? Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that's going to happen, but I was unprepared to handle the direction it was going. And I didn't know. I didn't know what was going to come around the corner. And I think the music completely enhanced that. Completely. It did not, you know, there's sometimes when you see a 90s film or a late 90s film where you're like, this is the 90s. Like, they're just, you know, the type of music, like somebody discovered an electric keyboard today, or, you know, and I don't feel that this movie shouted its 90s-ness. I think it perfectly served the story. And while I think the technology that we see and the cell phones, especially the cell phones, you know, it definitely roots it in this era. And like Tristan said, there's kind of that between 99 and 2000, like there really was kind of a shift. You know, you can very clearly kind of tell when a movie is 90s or aughts. And but I think the music worked great for this. And yeah, it flows right into Gladiator. I mean, the only connection I really see between it and Gladiator is Russell Crowe. I don't really see a connection music wise. There's too many differences between a tobacco whistleblower 90s film and whatever AD Gladiator. Like, it doesn't mix to me.
I'm going to leave it to Tristan, because I know that I think that Lisa Gerrard's vocals do. I mean, maybe it's just that her voice is so distinctive that I'm hearing something I want to. But I will say that when you say something like 99 into the aughts, I feel this is a total rabbit hole. I promise I'll get us back. I heard an ad the other day for a new streaming service that talked about showing, you know, all of these things you want to watch. And it said, travel back to the turn of the century. And in my brain, I thought, wait, there was no TV back in the 1900s. Oh, that's right. It's a different, oh gosh, I feel old. But Tristan, same question to you about the music. Do you see a success with this score? And do you hear Lisa Gerrard peeking through in such a way that you think Gladiator at a couple of moments?
In terms of the second question, I absolutely was hearing Gladiator, hands down, completely took me out of the moments, because I'm just like, oh yeah, Gladiator, Lisa Gerrard, because what she's singing and the tone she's singing in is so close to being verbatim that I almost looked it up. Like, I almost pulled out my Gladiator soundtrack, because like there's a change in tone at the tail end of her last two syllables, very last two syllables. It's almost the difference between Under Pressure and Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby. Like, that's that's barely the difference.
No, they go dun dun, like, dun, dun, could, dun 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 dun, and we go dun dun.
Yeah. Yeah. That is basically exactly right, because like I can just see that Gerrard was just like, you know what, Insider worked really well. Let me just there we
like
go.
Like, they laid down a temp track from the Insider when they're editing, and they're like, you know what, just do the same thing.
but let's remember, Lisa Gerrard was not the first pick of Hans Zimmer for Gladiator. Just to add that little asterisk on that, he wanted a different vocalist, and Lisa Gerrard came on afterward. So that could be interesting in and of itself. But anyway.
But to add on to that, I did not like the music in this movie at all. I thought it was distracting. I thought it was portentous. I thought it was, I don't think it fit the moment. I think the Lisa Gerrard stuff was way out of whack. She should not have been in this film whatsoever. That music did not belong in the moments that we saw. And also that lone saxophone was so distracting. It completely took me out of it. Like, there's so many times when the music took me out of it. Like, the lone saxophone, I was just like, what is this, 1972? Like, what is going on? And it just, yeah, no, I did not like the music at all in this.
Fair enough. But, you know, we talked about camera technology, and we've talked about signatures. There's one shot in specific I really want to talk about in this. And I think it is overlooked because the digital chicanery of the Matrix in episode one garnered the most headlines. But there is a specific moment where Russell Crowe as Wiegand is sitting, having potentially very dark thoughts in his hotel room. And he looks and the scene changes so that he's still sitting in his hotel room, but we see what he sees, his hallucination of his daughters playing in a background by a Victory Garden, and he can't participate and he's rooted in his place. And even his color is different from everything else that's going on around him. But Darren, for 1999,
no, you're right.
I would argue that this is an incredibly impressive shot. And an incredibly effective shot. Do you think that this deserves more of a mention in the history books for helping push digital background manipulation? It's just, if it had come out in 98, it gets more press than it does in 99.
No, I think you're right. Because now that you mentioned it, I mean, I loved that shot, but it was, I almost didn't notice that shot. Like, it was so, it just happened. And I didn't once think, wait, this is 99. How did they do? It just came and went and flowed into my eyes seeing that. It kind of reminds me of, I mean, they're pseudo purposely making it look technology, but in like Minority Report, where he's watching the playback tapes of his son. And now that obviously is trying to look like a machine and not a hallucination. But yeah, no, you're right. Like, how did they do that in 99? I'm sure he was in a room full of green or maybe blue. But that's all the praise I can really give it, is that it's flowed and happened so smoothly that I did not realize consciously that I'm looking at an effect. I just absorbed it as it happened.
What about you, Tristan?
It's my least favorite part of the movie.
Of course it is. Makes sense. Totally makes sense to me. Explain why.
I felt so bad. Like, when you went into this, I was just like, oh, please don't talk about the thing. Don't talk about the wall. God dang it. He's talking about the wall.
Wow.
I'm gonna have to be the jackass that says he didn't like it.
But the thing, you always seemed like such a cuddly and emotional person. Why did this moment fail to connect?
I loved the moment. I loved the moment. Like,
you don't
I
want to
really
pick up the phone, do you, Tristan? That's it. You just want to zone out.
No, I thought about some people, you know, in my own life, you know, like when this scene happened, you know, like people I care about. And so I really connected on an emotional level, but the effect was completely unnecessary and drew attention upon itself. It insists upon itself. Sorry, I just wanted to say that. I think it drew way too much attention upon itself, and it was completely unnecessary. And I hate to do this. I hate to go back to Gladiator. But when at the very end of Gladiator, when Maximus is bleeding out, and he's standing in the middle of the Colosseum, and everyone's around him, but then you see him kind of look off, like he kind of gets kind of hazy in his eyes. And then he sees his wife and his son in the distance, and we see what he sees. But then we cut back, and he's still in the Colosseum. And then we cut back to the mom and son again, cut to Russell Crowe still there. And then we cut and we see the Colosseum. We see what's actually around him. That is all you needed. You needed the magic of juxtaposition, not CGI trickery. And I just rolled my eyes at this moment. It's like, ugh.
Wow. Heartless. But I actually wind up on Team Darren with this one. Hashtag Team Darren. Because, Darren, this is one of my favorite moments in the entire film. Always has been. I think it's effective. And I think it's, I will go out and I will do a complete 180 from you, Tristan. I think this is a brilliant use of the technology. Because I think, Darren, to speak to what you're talking about with, why is it successful? And I think it's because it does not start the effect in his field of vision, which would have been roughly center of the shot. Everything starts dissolving off in the corner behind him.
And that's where everything starts dissolving into the fantasy that he's seeing. And I think that's why it winds up being as successful, I would argue, as it does. But let's go ahead and jump in. And Darren, I like what you've had to say, so I'll toss it to you first. But naturally, editing and a larger part of that discussion, pace, is always a question when you come to a Michael Mann movie, because the man is incapable of directing something. I'd love to see a Michael Mann movie that was 90 minutes because I really think it would cause him just to have a stroke and die, because I don't think he's capable.
It was a little long. I was like, okay, we're still here. We go. Okay. It's like, how long is this? Is it the count up or the countdown timer? Yeah, well, I think I'll just come back to what I said earlier about the third act. And I totally felt like the story was over. Like, really, when they didn't air it, I'm like, well, what else is there to say? Like, I don't feel like this is the kind of story where the corporation's going to lose, or like the corporation as far as CNN. And I mean, obviously, I don't know. It almost felt like this is the ending that we made up to round out the story in a happy way, but the actual ending was, nope, we didn't air it, and his life was ruined for nothing, the end. So I almost could have stopped the movie at 2/3, but yeah, because it changes protagonists, it changes, you know, the flow. But yeah, but as far as just general editing, you know, I felt it. And maybe this is more cinematography and shot selection, but again, the tension, there was so much tension in this movie. There were times where you're like on Russell Crowe, like you are in his face a lot of the time, feeling that emotion on his face as he's trying to figure things out. I think I noticed there was like a scene, I think, where they were all in an elevator, and it was like shot of the middle person, shot of left. Like there was no wide shot because we were jammed as we're heading off to do the day's work. But yeah, no, it was, again, I think for me, it's going to suffer in the third act because of how much it kind of shifted, story wise, protagonist wise. That's the direction I'm leaning.
I see. I'll leave it for our wrap up stuff, but I don't agree necessarily that it shifts protagonists. I see this all as Lo Bergman's story, but I think that what winds up undercutting that a little bit in the meat of the sandwich in the middle part of the film is that Crowe is so good as Jeffrey Wigand. It's one of those supporting performances that winds up causing it, you know, you wind up more emotionally connected to him for a time than to Bergman. But Tristan, let's keep it related to editing here. Do you think that this film finds its right pace, or do you think, like the criticism you offered of Heat, where it's like, this really could have been 10 or 15 minutes shorter?
With Heat, it was shortening some sequences because I felt like it was breathing too long. But like where with Heat, I remember talking with my wife and I was like, yeah, with Heat, like it's super long and you feel the length, but you're interested the entire time. With Insider, as I'm watching it, I'm not thinking like, oh, you know, like need to shorten some scenes. I'm like, they need to get rid of some scenes. This is way too long. I feel like you could easily cut 30 minutes. With Heat, I feel like you just tighten it up. With this one, slash it. It's way too long. It's way too self-indulgent. You have some really, really great pieces. You have some really great interaction. And in terms of the third act, I'm probably not going to be as harsh on the third act as Darren's going to be, because that's when you get righteous indignation. And that is beautiful in this movie. And I am an unabashed fan of yelly Al Pacino. Oh my gosh. Like give me yelling. I'd watch a movie where he'd be yelling at a barista for getting his order wrong, and he's the asshole. You know, like I would still watch that movie just because I love hearing him yell. But this, because he is morally right, because he is standing on the right side of history, you are rooting for him, sometimes literally, like, yeah, you know, like you want to, you know, fist pump the air. And so that I really like, and those moments I really like. And I just feel like you need to use those moments as your anchor, and you don't have to show every single thing that Pacino does. Like, you need to do a little, I know this goes against good filmmaking, but sometimes it's okay to tell and not show. Sometimes it's okay to have a conversation instead of walking around and showing the individual doing the thing that they say they're going to do. So I think in terms of editing, there was a few times when I was really confused by the editing choices. There's actually one in particular, like if we're talking about the microcosm of editing, and like, I feel like, John, you address editing on a macro level where you're mm-hmm. thinking about pacing, scene structure. And when I'm thinking about editing, I'm literally thinking about shot A selection, shot B selection, and the juxtaposition between the two. There's one moment when Al Pacino's character is calling the Mississippi lawyers, like Ron Motley and the AD and everybody like that. Like, he's calling them on the phone, they're on the plane, and they're having a conversation. And it's like we shoot on, like, we're on the plane, we're on the ground with Pacino. They're on the phone, on the plane, on the ground, on the plane, on the ground. And then all of a sudden, like, the conversation's over and we cut, and they're walking, the scene is done, it's over, and they're walking on the tarmac. Why do we need to see them walking on the tarmac? It was really weird. Like, they were inside the plane and all of a sudden they weren't. But the conversation had already ended. It was a really, really strange editing choice, and it just kind of popped in my head, and I needed to get that out. But in terms of a macro level, this movie could easily be 2 hours.
That much? You think they could cut that much from it?
Maybe not. Maybe I'm overstating a little bit. Like, what is this?
Oh, it's like,
this is 2:37.
37, yeah.
So I feel like this could be 2:15. I really do.
That is a healthy chunk of film to cut out.
It is a healthy chunk, but I feel like, you know, like if you restructure it in a way, and I'm talking about a complete restructure, like if you wanted to get it down in length, I really think you could, and it might even appease people like Darren, who struggled with the third act, by restructuring things around and keeping Wiegand a little bit more throughout it.
Well, what do you think of that, the last shot, Tristan, when it kind of goes all slow-mo and he's throwing his coat on and walking out at the, you know, because I agree with what you're saying. I did like the parts of the third act where he's in the right and he's just riding that moral high ground. But it's funny. It makes that last shot made me think of this trend on Twitter right now, which is if such and such came out in 2007 and it's just these clips and then they overdub the doomsday clock by the Smashing Pumpkins from the end of Transformers in 2007. It's as if like, because that song was so ingrained in that kind of moment. And I kind of started to picture that playing as he's like walking out, you know, slow-mo, tossing his jack coat on. I'm in the right. Anyway, yeah, I think we're going to disagree on the third act, not as severely as to come to blows, but,
to answer your question, it did feel a little cheesy, but John thinks this is, you know, this is, Bergman's film, and I have this feeling that you and I think it's Wiegand's film.
I do.
And that's where we kind of get that protagonist confusion. So, because I think I felt like maybe I was in the middle, but at the same time, because you asked that question about the final shot, I felt it was wrong to end on that as the final shot. It should have been Wiegand with his kids. Like, it, I mean, it, timeline-wise, it couldn't have been him and his kids watching the right. special, but it should have been
in the garden doing something. Some sort, you know,
doing in the garden would have been absolutely perfect, or like a makeshift cart, something like that, to showcase a little bit of hope.
Shopping in the vegetable section of the grocery store, anything involving gardens.
Anything involving the garden or the kids or whatever it is, because this entire movie, you see this guy's life get destroyed, and to the point where you're watching it, you're kind of like, should you put a gun in your mouth? You know, like you're just like, oh my God, I don't know. You know, like Michael Mann does a fantastic job of showing this guy's life implode, that you were like, as an audience member, I should rephrase that. I didn't mean it the way I said it. It questions, wow, why hasn't this guy killed himself? Like, we've seen fictional characters do it for less.
And when his wife is he's like, can we talk about it when I get back? And his wife's like, sure. And you know when she said, like, well, she's not going to be there. She's gone. She's already planning.
And the kids are going to be gone. We all know what the next scene is. Yeah, absolutely. And so, like, that's why we should have ended on some sort of hope, not like we should have ended with Wiegand rebuilding somewhat of his life, not Bergman getting
or even
job.
Shots of news history of the tobacco company paying out billions
I think that would betray the tone of the film as a whole, because while this is dramatized and while a lot of these things are larger than life in the context of the film, I think that very much what it drives for is that at the end of the day, this is just a story, not to diminish what is being done historically or Wiegand, or the fact that Bergman seems to be a pretty stand-up guy, you know, working on his behalf and trying to protect him as best he can and everything like that. I'm talking about, this is something where this is a day in the life for somebody who's producing news. There are hundreds of stories like this. And so I think it's more in keeping with the tone of, from Bergman's point of view, at least, he did the right thing here and he's going to keep going. But this is just another episode. Because we're already, by the end of this, he's already on to the fact that they're about to get the Unabomber. And so this is something where this chapter is just a chapter in his life. And Wiegand being unresolved. I mean, when Roth, amazingly, the screenwriter of Forrest Gump writes this movie with Mann. And when Roth and Mann sat down with Wiegand, Wiegand still wouldn't talk to them because of the confidentiality agreement. They're like, he was still bound by it at the time that he was talking to them about the script. So I think that there's very much a sense, I would argue that there's much more of a sense of leaving all of us with the impression that there is no easy answer for any of this through the whole thing. And that at the end, I think it would have betrayed the tone of the movie to have
the happy ending,
that moment of, and then everything was okay, because it isn't. It's not okay at the end, right? CBS has had this big internal row about what hand corporate has in their news division. Bergman has quit his job on principle right after he's delivered this incredible story that has tremendous implications for the American public. And even though Wiegand gets vindicated at the end, he still lost everything. He still hasn't put anything back together. And I'm saying that respectfully. I get what you guys are saying. I totally do, because we're talking about a movie and it is a dramatization. I just think that it's very much a conscious choice on Mann's part not to give us that happy moment at the end, because it feels in keeping, honestly, with the director of Heat or even Collateral, where there's this unresolved sense of, yeah, it's over, but all you get is a breath, and then tomorrow is just another day, and it's going to be challenging in its own ways.
I think that just goes down to the fundamental differences of how we see the movie and the differences of how we see the movie and who the protagonist is. Because if you believe that Bergman is the protagonist, I mean, I think you're going to agree with the director of the film. I think you're going to be like, yeah, this is just a chapter in the life. And with Darren and I, with us seeing as Wigan as the protagonist, we want some resolution. It doesn't have to be like, I definitely wasn't saying like, oh, it needs to be a happy-go-lucky. He gets his wife back,
running back in his arms. Like, I would not have bought that.
No, like not that at all. But just like, it's kind of like what Julie Taymor did with Titus, with Hopkins and Titus. You know, like it's the Shakespeare's most violent play, and it ends horribly, like most of his plays. But in the end of her interpretation, she has the boy, the kind of like the narrator that she shuffled around the piece, like the boy pick up this baby and kind of like walk off into the light. And it wasn't saying that things that happened previously didn't happen. It wasn't saying that things that have like the, all those heinous human things that happened in Titus, were resolved. It was just like, humanity goes on, we continue, there is light at the end of the tunnel, kind of thing. And it just, from a storytelling standpoint, as someone who sees Wigand as a protagonist, it would have been cool to see a little bit of a rebuild, not a whole reset.
Well, he gets to have his daughter acknowledges him as it's airing on television, looks up and acknowledges, and he has that hope there that someday she's going to understand why it was so important for him to do what
he did. Oh, absolutely. And I just would have liked something like that at the end, as opposed to Bergman walking away from the camera in slow motion.
So you're saying a juxtaposition of wrap up Bergman first and then wrap up Wigand?
Yeah.
Yes.
Or kind of something that would be like right before the credits where it's on black and like the text comes up and there's like a picture in picture of like a news clip from reality. And it says like, and in such and such a time, you know, they were like the largest payout of, you know, of a lawsuit was given for the tobacco company, like, or something like that. Kind of a,
well, they did though.
They did do that.
They had copy on the screen at the end.
That's true.
Talking about what happened. And I say to give man credit is that it's in big, clear letters at the end. It's not simply based on a true story at the beginning. He cops to it on that title card saying, we dramatize things. This isn't exactly real, what you just witnessed. I think that was a very responsible thing for the filmmaker to do.
And even went so far as to point something out in the film.
Right.
That was unconfirmed. I thought that was pretty gutsy for a filmmaker to actually call themselves out, whether just like, you know, the harassment.
It was the bullet Wigand in the received. Mailbox.
The bullet in the mailbox had never been confirmed. Like that kind of thing. Like that's a specific thing that I'm sure that I'm sure corporate is like, you gotta put that in. This is the one thing that we're gonna push you on. You gotta put that
in. Yeah, I know we're having a movie about integrity and standing up against sponsors and investors and everything, but it's kind of a movie tradition. We gotta put that in there just in case. And movies like this, you know, just speaking of that indemnification thing, it always cracks me up that movies like this that are very clearly based on a true story and cop to that still have the disclaimer at the end. It's like any resemblance to real people, fictional or otherwise. Oh no, that's not at all. It's like, but it's based on a true story. What are you talking about? Like what? I don't know.
Oh, one thing I want to mention before we wrap up is I talked about kind of great performances, and I talked about like the righteous indignation that Pacino gave. I also love the moment that Plummer gave, like when he was yelling at Gina Gershon, like all the kind of scene, and Plummer did a fantastic job through this entire film. Yeah, of course it's Plummer, he's a pro, you know, it's just he is what he is. But I do want to talk about Gina Gershon because I don't think she gets enough credit in a lot of the stuff that she does, and specifically this is a role that I feel would get left out of the conversation, but she gave a very real performance in my opinion. This was a very spot on, like, no, she is a corporate lawyer. Like, you know this woman's history. You know the crap that she's had to go through. You know what she has to deal with on a daily basis. You know that she's looking out for the company. She's looking out for herself. And it's just, there's so much conveyed in one scene. And it's a character that she doesn't normally play. And that you don't normally see her in. And so I really appreciated that. I wanted to throw her in there before we moved on. And I have a quote from Russell Crowe about Michael Mann that I wanted to read. Michael Mann is a director that some actors talk with in terms of terror, but I loved working with him because he is so detailed. He puts so much thought into everything that he wants to do. He would often arrive to set with a file on a particular scene, and sometimes there would be little notes that he made for himself. Sometimes there would be photographs or imagery that he thought connected somehow to the scene. From an actor's point of view, if you want to be deeply focused on what you're doing, Michael Mann set such a wonderful atmosphere and platform for an actor like that.
And so that is a terrific quote. And I think it's a great way to lead into you, Tristan, justifying how many cigarettes out of 5 you give The Insider.
Well, I wanted to give this 3 because of the reasons that I talked about. Horrible music, editing that kind of takes you out of it, needed to cut 25 minutes. But the performances were amazing. Absolutely amazing. From Pacino, Plummer, Gershon, from Crowe, McGill. Even Philip Baker Hall, not even Philip Baker Hall, but Philip Baker Hall, of course, and Venora. Everybody did a fantastic job. And Russell Crowe was nominated for the Oscar for this.
Yes.
And he was for A Beautiful Mind and then Gladiator, as in 1, 2, 3, I think. Or was it Gladiator? It was Gladiator next and then A Beautiful Mind, I think. Yep. That's a pretty good run for an actor.
It's pretty solid.
So I'm giving it 3.5 for the performances.
And Darren, justify your rating for The Insider. Tell us how many sealed indictments out of 5 you give this one.
I don't care about if they're sealed or not. I'm just going to talk about it. I'll echo what Tristan said, that the acting was great. I often think of Gladiator when I think of Russell Crowe. Now I'm going to think of this movie because his performance is so strong, and it's like, oh my gosh, this guy can act. Not that we didn't know that, but seeing this really, really good performance, I believe this was a man losing everything, wrestling with decisions, deciding whether or not, like, it did not feel like an actor playing a person, which I think is a great compliment. And I just loved all the casting in this. I mean, there's actors popping up left and right. I personally love the principal of the school he goes to work to, because that is Lynn Thinpeg, the Acme Crime Net chief from Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. I recognize her immediately.
She will never not be that person in my mind.
But you know what? I didn't care because I thought it was a great little bit part. So I am going to give it a 3. Not that I didn't like it. It is kind of a sliding scale for Mann. I went from a 5 with Mohicans to a 4 with Heat to a 3 with this. I don't necessarily feel that it's sliding in that direction, but for me, it is kind of, the third act was rough for me. I really disengaged a lot. And probably, like Tristan said, that's probably because I view this more as Russell Crowe's film than it is, you know. So I don't give it a 3 in, I mean, it's not a 1, it's not a 2. It's definitely a great film. I think I'm not surprised it didn't do as well at the box office just because of the subject matter, but it's definitely worth watching. I'll probably rewatch this because the tension, the acting and the tension, I felt more engaged in what is going to happen. And maybe that's why I kind of knock it down a peg in the third act, because of what actually happened and how it kind of took that turn for me. So I'm giving it 3 sealed affidavits. Don't wait for the translation. But
I come in with a 4.5. Movie's maybe about 5 minutes too long, maybe 10. But I see it more as a tightening situation. It's Bergman's story. There are a couple of moments I could do without. And while I do hear, you know, echoes of Gladiator in it, this came out first. So it's more that I hear echoes of The Insider and Gladiator now.
Not even now. I mean, I saw this back in the day, as it were. So, you know, let's blame Hans Zimmer on ripping somebody off instead of vice versa. All right, y'all, just because you like Gladiator better. But yeah, this is a 4.5. I think it's a. I had forgotten how engaging this is, and how what will keep it from ever really hitting a 5 is man is a very. It's going to be a really weird way to say it, but he's a very emotionally distant director. He keeps the audience, no matter what, we're not embracing these characters. We're observing them. And I think that's the only thing that sort of works to the film's detriment is we're fully aware that we're watching something unfold in almost a documentary fashion, which keeps us from being as invested as we would be with a full-blown dramatic take on everything. Not a terrible thing, not a bad choice, but I think that's what those factors put together keep it at a 4.5 instead of 5. So, you know, given the ratings that everybody's heard, for me, for Manhunter, Last Mohicans, Heat, and The Insider, everybody can understand why I was so excited to enter the House of Man, as it were. But here we close the door on the House of Man, and in Tristan's case, possibly nail the door shut so we can never go back in again. And then Darren glues the hinges so that they will never turn. And we are getting ready to go into episode 100, which will be a special surprise episode that we can't wait to deliver to you. But I'm under a confidentiality agreement, and I don't want to have to sue Tristan and Darren for violating their NDAs. So we'll catch you next time here on House Lights.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.